Welcome to the afterword, where the walls are still white. It's not quite as cold in here, though, and I'm staring at a cowboy hat that's not really a cowboy hat on Vince's head. I don't know what else to say.
Okay.
This is a podcast of the Town Church. The goal of this podcast is to look at more layers of the text that was just preached. In our case, that's 1 Samuel 26
and 7.
6 and 7. Thank you. And we also want to see in this text, what more of God's glory do we see? So I want to start, though, with an intro question provided by one of our, not panelists, what do we call ourselves?
The podcaster?
The podcaster. By the way, I'm joined by Betty and Vince and Kirsten and I'm Eric. All right, here's the question. If you had to pick one pair of shoes that you would have for the rest of your life and no other shoes, what pair of shoes would you pick?
It's an impossible question.
You are my go-to, I'm not going to answer that question person.
It's an impossible question.
So. Yeah, whoever thought of this was not thinking well.
Well, because, I mean, you have to have, I'm often a form over function, and yet with flat feet and like bone grafting in my feet and two major ankle surgeries, often it has to be function over form, but I'm like, I just don't know that I could choose. Like, if I had to pick one pair, it'd have to be a pair of tennis shoes, but I'm like, wah, wah.
Is there a particular pair of tennis shoes that stands out above the rest for you?
Not really, no.
Okay.
No. We've gone, like, the last three trips we've gone on, I thought I packed appropriately, and after, like, walking for, what, less than a mile? I've had like blisters
oh,
on the
no.
bottoms of my feet. And, you know, so we've had to stop somewhere and buy a pair of tennis shoes for me. So I have a lot of tennis shoes.
You have some trauma around tennis shoes.
She has a lot of shoes that we have purchased in other cities and countries because we had to. Not because we wanted to, because we had to.
Yeah, because we had to. Because I thought, okay, this pair of shoes is going to be great for me. I've walked a lot. They're good. And then I wear them wherever we are. And I'm like, I can't walk in these. Like, I literally have blisters all over the... I mean, where you should have an arch.
Yeah.
I get blisters there. So anyway, it's an impossible question.
Vince, what pair would you choose?
Cowboy boots.
You would not. You
don't
even own a pair.
You have a pair of cowboy boots.
Wait, I'm sorry. What was the question?
Should we narrow into pairs that you own?
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that it was what pair of shoes do you currently own?
It wasn't. But I'm wondering right now
okay,
if we
so
should narrow
cowboy
it.
But
boots.
What if they're not comfortable? What if they hurt your feet?
Are we choosing shoes that
Can
aren't
you
comfortable?
Can you trail run in cowboy boots? Oh.
Wait, let's back up.
You're getting attacked about your cowboy boots.
Answering the question. Did anyone question your
Because I said it's an impossible question, so my answer stands. But I don't. I mean, I couldn't see you out there in your like pickle shorts and cowboy boots running trails.
Pickle shorts? What are pickle shorts?
I have a pair of running shorts that have pickles all over them.
I'm not going to comment. But would you wear cowboy boots with your pickle shorts?
What was the question again?
If you had one pair of shoes
okay.
that you only have one for the rest of your life, what would they be?
Can I answer the question or do I have to...
You can answer it, but you might be ridiculed for it.
Okay, well, I answered.
Okay, we'll Betty, what about you?
I'd probably choose my... I'm not allowed to say like a brand. Is that legal?
Sure.
Whatever you say, it will be ridiculed. So just answer. Do whatever.
I love your answer, Betty.
Thanks, Kirsten. My new Balance shoes that I got because they're comfortable and I can walk a lot in them and they go good with outfits.
It's the same pair I bought when we were in London.
London.
Yeah, when we were in London because the shoes I brought... did not work and I bought them so they're the exact same ones. They're very comfortable.
They're very comfortable
and
they look good with like fancy clothes or less fancy clothes.
So you actually might have the same pair, both of you.
We do.
Yeah.
Same with boots.
Huh. All right. Well, let's move
Eric?
Right. I have no idea. You can't pick something that works for water, winter, summer, walking, hiking, all of that.
Chacos.
If I love chacos.
Cowboy boots.
That works for a lot. Cowboy boots? No, probably some pair of tennis shoes. Probably
because you can wear tennis shoes in the water.
Yep.
You can wear cowboy boots in the water.
You can get away with it in the winter and the summer.
Yeah, cowboy
and
boots
and chacos. You can just wear socks.
But what about like when you're doing a funeral You're gonna show up with sneakers?
Cowboy boots.
Can you borrow someone else's shoes for special occasions?
Yeah, what are the rules?
That's a good question.
How about we move on?
Yeah.
We are 5 minutes in. Hey, Vince, give us a recap from the text.
All right. I don't have my Bible in front of me, so I'm going to try to do it without anything in front of me. David, after Saul's words to David in chapter 25, we see that Saul is still hunting down David. He finds that David's in the wilderness, so he gets 3,000 men to go after him. David learns of this, and David moves over to, for some reason, tries to find Saul in his camp, finds him, asks if anybody will go with him. His nephew agrees to go with him, and he goes over. The nephew says, "It's your chance, kill him." David decides, "No, let's just take his spear and his jar of water and go back." He goes back to his side of the valley and yells across the valley, jabbing at Abner, who's the commander of the army. And when he's poking at Abner for not protecting Saul, Saul wakes up and says, "Is that you?" David responds with questions for Saul about why he's treated him this way. Basically saying, "What have I done? Why are you treating me this way?" Saul then confesses to David, or at least what seems like a confession to David. "Yep, I've been wrong. I've sinned against you. I've made mistakes. I shouldn't have done that." David, this is back and forth. David responds with, "All the people around me are wanting me to go off and serve other gods. Is that what you want?" And Saul responds, "No, I've sinned against you." And then he gives this beautiful send off to David that is, it's actually kind of funny the way that he says it. It's very vague. "You are blessed, my son David. You will do many things and will succeed in them," which I think tips David off that this is insincere. Saul is not actually sincere in his confession. So David leaves and goes to live with the Philistines for a year and 4 months and does these like side day trips with his men to kill off different armies, different areas, enemies of Israel. And the Philistine king, Achish, thinks that David is with them, and so allows him to stick around there with them. And the chapter just sort of ends out, a short chapter ends out with David being among the Philistines.
It seems like a lot of this is familiar with David again not killing Saul, with the back and forth, the parting of ways. The Ziphites again betray David a second time. He goes back to Gath, the second time, to try to find refuge there. We're seeing a lot of repeating. I think here's my first question about the text. Why, we're speculating here, why do you think David goes into Saul's camp at night in the first place? Like, what was his plan when he initially set out to go over there?
Yeah, I think in all of the questions, I know we've got several questions that we'll think through. They are all speculation, but I think what it does is the author is setting up the scenario where we see the tension. He goes there, we don't know why, but we understand that there's this frustration. Because right before that, it says that Saul took 3,000 men out to find David. Well, who in their right mind would know someone's after me with 3,000 men? Maybe I'll move toward them. So there's some conflicting stuff going on in David's mind. He's wrestling with, what am I doing? I'm tired of this. It seems as if he's going towards Saul to try to do away with this problem once and for all. Now, it's speculation. There's nothing in the text that shows that or says that, but I think we can get to that conclusion.
Man, so there's lots of layers to David here. He isn't just this hero that always looks and sees things clearly, but there's layers, conflicted, back and forth.
Yeah.
It seems like it's chapter to chapter in some respects here.
Yeah, and still he's a man after God's heart. And I tried to bring this out on Sunday. I think it's because we see him often realize his sin, realize his mistakes, confess them as such, and turn from them. I mean, we don't look at somebody in, I mean, so we commissioned two new elders yesterday, John and Will, and both of those men, I've spent a lot of time with them. I would say they're godly men, but I don't say that necessarily because they have everything together. I say that because I've been with them enough to know they recognize where they sin, and they're open to talking about that, and they're open to their grief about their sin and their desire to turn from it. That's why I would call John and Will godly men. And I think we see that of David.
This may be a stretch. You can correct me as I process out loud.
Well,
but
I don't know if I'm in a place of correction right now since I tried.
Comment.
Yeah, after my boot comment, I feel like I'm in the place of needing correction.
I just want to see you run trails with boots
on. You want to see me in boots, is what you want to see, and shorts.
It's true. It's a good look. It really is.
I will do that.
Anyway, in both last week's passage and this week's passage, it seems like what we see is that David is confronted with temptation and the battle to resist temptation. And so in, you know, both cases, well, the first case, Saul came to him in the cave and there was the temptation of killing him and he didn't. And in this case, he went to the temptation to maybe look at Saul. And so I think we see a picture of what it is to face temptation. And when we have people in our lives that don't necessarily help us make good choices, you know, that Abishai, is that his name? His cousin, nephew, sister, his cousin,
nephew
said, you know, I'll kill him and I'll do it. I'll just do it quickly, you know? And so it was almost like he was kind of trying to tempt David into temptation and saying, it's not going to take me two strikes to kill him. I'll do it once. I'll do it quick. No one will know. And so I just see a really big kind of overview picture of facing temptation and the people in our lives that are kind of pushing us towards that rather than walking away from it.
And if that's the case, that means that David, in the heat of the moment, felt conviction over that and changed course. Like, one is the hardest change course, which is to the point I think that you were making, Vince. He's someone who had a heart that was soft to the Spirit.
Yep. It does seem that way.
Yeah.
But the hope is that for all of us who have the Spirit, that we experience conviction, confess our sin, and turn from it. And that cycle it becomes less and less, or that cycle becomes shorter and shorter. I feel like, I mean, we're 27 chapters in, and it seems to be a repetitive cycle for David. And in some ways, which we'll see in the coming weeks, an increasingly repetitive cycle.
Why do you think he poked Abner? So there, he has a spear, he has the water jug, he's calling across the mountain to Saul, Abner's there, and David pokes at Abner saying, you didn't do your job protecting your king last night. He states it pretty strongly. What's the rationale there? What do you think he's trying to get at?
Yeah, I think again, speculation, but I think it's showing David's humanity. It's showing his just one more push at the situation. I could have done this. Where were you? I'm not the one who should be chased down. You should have done this and you didn't, and you're a part of Saul's people. I think it's that conflicting. We get in these situations, we all do, or I'll speak for myself. I get in these situations where I'm feeling attacked, like about cowboy boots, and I feel the need to defend, or I feel the need to sort of raise my position to be seen, or to be seen as significant, and my desire to have a pair of boots that I just don't have yet. And so for David, I think he's yelling across the valley in an attempt to defend himself and to say, hey, I'm not the
bad guy.
I'm not the person of focus here. I shouldn't be. And to show his power, to show that he's got a hand up. Look what I could have done. So same with, we referenced this last week, and some commentators that I read talk about this too. Why was the reason he took a corner of the robe? Mm-hmm. Like what was that about? Other than to say, look what I could have done, but I didn't. So it's just a power play in his flesh to show this is what I could have done and I didn't.
Is it also kind of rubbing it in?
It seems like it.
I don't know. I think about the interactions between my boys, and like when one of them is victorious over something, there's not like this often, this humble, like good sportsmanship. It's like a, let me rub it in your face. And then I'm just going to keep bringing it up over and over and over again. And so I wonder if there was a piece of just him wanting to rub it in and say, look what I did.
Mm-hmm. I took it as maybe David trying to divide Saul and Abner. Maybe then Saul would have some questions about Abner, or they would get into it a little bit more. That's pure speculation.
Yeah, who knows? I think we could land on this, that I don't think the motives were pure.
Yeah.
Whatever the case, I don't think his motives were, hey, this will be honoring to God if I yell across the mountain this.
About how bad a job you're doing, Abner.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to ask another question. Can I keep like rapid firing this? And we'll get to some application things here shortly. What do you think, again, some speculation here, what is David's plan when he goes to live with the Philistines at Gath? What's his long-term plan? And we know he's trying to escape from Saul to find protection. But then he's there for over a year. He's doing raids against Israel's enemies, but is pretty untruthful about it. So the Philistines don't know that he's doing that. Hey, let's say he's a year in. Like, what's he think? What do you think it's going to be in 3 years, 4 years?
And what's the significance of him going to Gath?
Okay, we're just going to ask questions.
Yeah.
These are quick shots, Vince. Quick shots.
These are the
quick hits.
Quick hits. Yeah, I think it's speculation still. It's unknown why he went to live with the Philistines, although he, in a way, he kind of calls it to, in his words to Saul, where he says the people want me to give up on God and just go serve other gods. Is that what you're wanting too? And I don't know if it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways of, I'm not even wanted among my own people. I guess I'll go live among other people. But you would think that after a year and 4 months, mm-hmm. of being there, like, okay, this isn't...
What's the plan?
This doesn't sit right. Especially someone who we've seen evidence of the sense of conviction for doing wrong, mm-hmm. and a turning from that, a confession of it and a turning from it. You would think that after a year and 4 months, there would be some sort of conviction there. So I think it shows he's settled into a lifestyle of deceiving the enemy, but still living a little bit under the umbrella of what God would want, you know, taking care of God's enemies. But I can do it in a way that's protected under this guise of this deception of, under the Philistines. And I think it's a picture of what we can often do. We feel this uneasiness about the situation we're in. We don't feel welcome. We don't feel a part of it. We think, what's the use in our exhaustion? And we take off in another direction. It feels more comfortable, and we try to set up a way of life under the umbrella of what God would want, but in a scenario that's not ideal, that's not honoring to God. But we try to justify it, rationalize it. The significance of Gath, I don't know. I mean, I think it's a primary place of the Philistines. It shows that David didn't just go to some suburb of Philistia and, like, you know, get some job at the Quick Trip, but he is all in. If I'm going to do this, I'm going all in.
Well, and from the earlier chapters, Saul was terrified of the Philistines. It says that he had a lot of fear, and so maybe going to the enemies of Saul was the place that David knew he would be safe, because Saul wouldn't pursue him there. And I mean, we see in here that it says that whenever David went to Gath, Saul stopped pursuing him. And so I think for the moment, he did get what he wanted. And the Ziphites, I read this week that the Ziphites were actually from the tribe of Judah. And so the Ziphites of all people should have been the ones that were protecting David and supporting him. Like, they were his people from his tribe. And so he wasn't even protected by his own people. And so, so he went to a place that he knew that Saul would probably not follow him.
Seems like there was someone else in the Bible who said he didn't have a place even in his own hometown or with his own family.
It was Jesus.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
It was Jesus. Yeah. I don't know. Another picture though I see is that, you know, at times when we're tired of enduring and we're tired of fighting and we stop enduring and we run away, like sometimes our immediate struggle that we're facing does lift. The thing that we're tired of enduring, the thing that we're tired of fighting to do correctly, that battle lifts. And that happened for David too. But with that, I think that we need to understand that God is often slow to bring judgment to things. He's slower than we are. And a verse that popped up this week is Ecclesiastes 8:11, and it says, "Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily, the heart of the children of man is fully set to do evil." And so I think sometimes we don't see we don't immediately see God's judgment, and in that we assume that it's okay to do. We assume it's okay to keep doing it because God is slow to bring judgment. And I think in this, you know, David set up camp. Like, he got comfortable there because there was no immediate discipline for him walking away.
And I think the enemy loves that. The enemy uses that sort of thing as affirmation for us. Oh, okay, here I am. I've been accepted here. I'm settling in. This is exactly where I need to be.
I am struck by, we mentioned this briefly, about the land of Israel and God's presence that David touches on. This is what David says here in verse 19 of chapter 26. David's talking to Saul. He says, "Now therefore, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If it is the Lord who has stirred you up against me, may he accept an offering. But if it is men, may they be cursed before the Lord." And here's the reason. "For they have driven me out this day that I should have no share in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, 'Go serve other gods.'" Verse 20. "Now therefore, let not my blood fall to the earth away from the presence of the Lord, for the king of Israel has come out to seek a single fly," and it goes on, "a single flea," and then it goes on. And then he voluntarily does exactly that. He leaves the promised land and goes, lives with the Philistines. I don't know all that's going on there, but it's really, really striking to me. They says, "This is what you're tempting me to do. Nobody would want that." And then he chooses that very thing. Yeah. This is God's anointed. In God's eyes, this is the legitimate king of Israel, now leaving the land of Israel, the very thing that he said he did not want to do. Is it fear primarily motivating David here? I'm tempted to actually see David going living with the Philistines as a gift from God. God is providing David protection. Hmm. Saul stops going after him. He's given a city by the Philistines, which is incredibly crazy to me. This is David who defeated Gath's hero, Goliath. Yeah, he's given a city. He's given protection. He's given favor. But yet he's doing the very thing that he says is the worst thing that could possibly happen to him by being driven away from his own land. It's confusing to me. And I don't know another way to see it other than it was actually a negative thing that David did. And maybe fear was the primary motivator.
I mean, how often, though, do you see someone who, who's claimed to be a Christian, who's walked with the Lord, and they walk away, and when they walk away, their life seems to flourish? You know, like, they have a lot of wins, they have a lot of good things that happen in their life, and it almost seems like there's this affirmation of, oh, yeah, this is a good direction, even though anybody who knows the Lord knows this is a terrible direction. Like, if you're not walking with the Lord, it's not going to go well with you. And again, I think there's this deception of the enemy that we equate things that shouldn't be equated. And so, you know, in this, maybe David's equating Saul not chasing him anymore, and he's been given favor by the king who, you know, I even the fact that he's willing to go back to a king that previously he had acted like a complete insane person in front of him, and yet that's who he goes to for help. And I think none of those things are good things. And yet I think it shows how misdirected David was and just his missight of things.
I also wonder if, again, so much of this is speculation. I wonder if, too, if David has, let me try to get all this out of my own head so that it makes sense. If David has a lack of trust in God and what God might do, and therefore tells Saul, what, am I supposed to go do this? In hopes that God may hear that and provide a plan where that doesn't need to happen.
Almost like a threat of sorts?
Or a fleece or something. Oh. Like, you know, I'll go do this. In hopes that God would say, there's no way that I'm going to let my servant go through something like that. And as he steps out, he doesn't see God moving in that direction. Again, speculation. But you wonder how much David is battling with his trust in God too.
Yeah, he's got to be.
Yeah.
And to like go back to the same place where he had to act like a madman to escape safely. I don't know. I think that's also pretty indicative.
Yeah, isn't it interesting too that the Achish doesn't even say any? He doesn't say, "Oh, I remember."
Is it the same king? It's a different name. Is it the same king? Isn't it a different name?
I think it's the same, same name.
Is it really? Yeah. I'm just misremembering. Yeah. That's what we're going to call it. Misremembering.
Yeah, and that he was willing to go back to a place that he completely humiliated himself in his lack of trust in God, and yet that's where he ran.
Yeah.
But this time, just, I don't know, maybe this is relevant. He was alone that time, right? Mm. And now he has all of his men.
400 men or however many. Yeah.
It's weird. This whole thing is weird to me, which maybe is part of the point. Like, it's just a strange time. And with what God is doing, giving David favor where he does, and yet David still, it's messy. Like, this is what life is like, is it not? Like, just messy, not super clear, black and white all the time. There's not just heroes and just villains.
When I said this word multiple times yesterday, it's exhausting.
Yeah.
The battle that David is having to do what is right, to not grow weary in doing what is good, to continue to do right in the face of just one thing after another, after another, after another. I mean, it's no wonder that he's like, forget this, I'm going to move in with the Philistines. It's exhausting.
Which is a great segue. That's the question I want to ask, moving to some application here and less speculation. Are there times in your life that you can look back, or maybe in the question that Vince asked yesterday, an area of your life where you are sensing the temptation to give up, or you're feeling really, really weary and need some encouragement to continue to endure? Was there anything that came to mind or currently comes to mind?
You're asking us to be vulnerable.
Yeah, I'm not going to answer this question.
No, you're
I'm
not.
Asking you
no.
to be vulnerable.
No, I tried with cowboy boots and was shot down. I'm done. From here on out, I'm posturing and faking everything I say.
For the next 5 minutes, this is a safe place. The one that came to mind, I'll start. How about that?
Oh.
The one that came to mind yesterday, and I've shared pieces of this, I think, before. I think you called it a besetting sin yesterday. Mm. Like those things that just seem to be core to who you are. Mine is making an idol of work, but not because of work itself, but because of what I think work can give me, which is value, significance, worth, that sort of thing. That at times feels virtually impossible for me to say no to and to set boundaries around. Mm. So that was the first thing that came to mind immediately. There would be, in some sense, so much easier for me to forget about it. I'm just going to dive full into whatever it is I think work is going to give me and be really unhealthy with that. So I'm not all head over heels into it, but I could be more. Yeah. And it does get tiring at times, continuing coming back to keeping it from not being as much of an idol as it could be.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, even the question that I posed on Sunday, because they are kind of private things. What's interesting is I believe, the person believes that it's a private, like this is between me and God, but this is something that just hangs on.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to get rid of it.
Yeah.
And it's embarrassing to talk about because I don't want people to know. This seems so, because all these other people have their their act together and this isn't a struggle for them. And so I don't want to share that with anyone because that's going to make me look silly. At this, what's crazy about it all is I would think that the people closest to you see that in you as well.
Yeah.
And if you're at a place where you're vulnerable enough to talk about it and bring it out, there's a couple things that come to mind. One, there's this fear that they're going to say, yeah, we've seen that in you. and that's just affirming this disgust that you have. So that's hard to face too. Or if you bring it up, that's a vulnerable place to be, and it feels scary to talk about it. And so you try to hide it and you try to manage it on your own, which is exactly what the enemy wants. So it's a really hard question to ask, even in a circle like this and a group of four people, because it's challenging to answer and not feel all those different things coming together.
Keep
going.
I was gonna say, I can even think of a couple of moments in the last couple of years. This is where the red flags really were going off, where this is gonna sound weird, but if I snuck away to work or gave work a little bit more time, it felt like I was getting away with something. Like the picture that comes to mind, I love cheesecake. But let's say I just ate way too much every day. I'd grab some. I would go in a dark closet so nobody could see that I ate the cheesecake. I try to cover my trail so nobody knew that I ate it. It's not exactly the same, but it started to feel like that, like almost an indulgence to myself with whatever it is I was doing. And that's pretty twisted.
Yeah. I would agree, Eric. That's really, really twisted. I mean, the cheesecake part, not so much.
But. You can understand that one. Yeah.
I think, too, there's the discouragement that comes with knowing that even when you have talked about it and invited people in, it's still there.
It hangs on.
And there's, you know, like for me with anxiety and fear, like there's not very much victory. And so it's really hard to keep bringing it up and just, I mean, like you said, like, it just hangs on. And I'm like, and that's, I think David felt that way about Saul. It just hung on and it hung on. And no matter how much he tried to run away from him, and no matter how much he tried to appeal to him, and no matter how much he tried to trust God, Saul just hung on. And I think it's that way with some of these things that are really hard, that even when we bring it into the light, and even when we're having people walk with us and praying with us and for us and battling it faithfully, it doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. And that's extremely discouraging.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say that's true. And in the moment too, it feels so freeing to bring it into the light. And then you think that that's like a turnaround. And then days later, it just hits you again. And it almost seems even worse too.
You get tired then of being that person that's just like asking people for prayer constantly about it and gaining no victory.
Yeah, I think this will be no shock to anyone who knows me, or no shock to anyone who doesn't know me probably, but I think the one that comes to my mind, and I hate it and love it, I mean, similar to what you say, Eric, like there's a lot of significance, is the way in which I can use words. That's powerful. I think God has given me some gifts there, but it's also a powerful tool, a sinful tool. I'm quick to say things that I probably shouldn't. And I walk away from almost every group. We just finished a little staff lunch and there's like eight things. I wish I wouldn't have said that. And it just hangs on. And I see it in a lot of different ways that I hate it. I want to push away, but it feels like the only move away from that is to be silent altogether, which is in some ways throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So that's not a good move either, but I wrestle with that, battle with that back and forth.
I've been having conversations a lot this last week that have kind of related to endurance. I feel like it's less with thinking about like the question about just certain sins that we wrestle with and just seem to have no victory over. But I think it's more been this year endurance and feeling pretty weary and what my relationship with God looks like outside of campus ministry and outside of college. I think that's been really hard for me to figure out and really hard to wrestle through this year. It just felt really different. He's felt very distant and removed, I think, in my life. And as the days pass, I think I'm just getting more and more tired of it and it's harder to persevere. But yeah, I just think it's been a season of endurance and I don't know what else I was going to say.
What would not enduring look like in this particular scenario?
I think just, I don't know if I would just say like giving up, but I think in this current like time, it's been like trying to like run from like personal time, like with the Lord, and really not being honest, I think, like with where I'm at, and just kind of trying to hide that all and cover things up, like with other outlets, maybe just trying to find satisfaction in like other things and maybe find more rest or fulfillment in other things. I guess that's what comes to mind.
Like distractions.
Yeah.
I think that is a good question to consider. I don't know that I have answers for it. But what would giving up look like in each of these scenarios? I mean, the end of that, of giving up, is absolutely destruction. I mean, the end of giving up in anxiety, where does that go? Where does that lead you? It seems like an ongoing battle, Kirsten, that you must face and you're determined to face. What does giving up in that situation look like? What does giving up in a situation where like I run my mouth and I say things that are harsh and I say things that are hard for other people to hear? And what does giving up that battle look like? Just to say, forget it, I'm done. I'm going to say whatever I want, I don't care. Well, the end of that is destroyed relationships right and left with no mending. At least now in a state where I'm not giving up, I'm fighting. My fight looks like me going back to people and saying, hey, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. Would you forgive me? So there's some move toward confession there. And the story with David's not over, by the way. We don't end David's life at the end of chapter 27. We've got more to go. But I don't, it's hard to consider what does giving up look like. But many people, maybe even our listener, has faced that. I've been in a place where I have given up, and this is what that looks like. So,
can we talk about that a little bit? When you're in that place of either feeling that temptation really hard, what are some ways that are helpful for our endurance? Yeah, let's just start with that. What are some practical things that can help us endure when we're feeling that?
And it may be helpful to talk about the specific things. If you haven't mentioned it, fine, but the specific things we're thinking through so that it does get practical.
So a couple practical things for me then in my particular case, which is workaholism, even though I don't like using that word because that feels a little bit too convicting.
It's labeled. Now you are that person.
Yeah. The practical things to help endure there is actually take a couple steps to put boundaries on it. So whether that's actually going home at 5, which I've gotten lax on lately, and I know it, but I haven't done anything about it really. It's to a lot of people, that's going to sound really, really simple, but for me, in this particular thing, that's a really big deal. But it's one step that then can start to shape the trajectory of my heart in a different way. And I've seen God actually use that. But then the temptation is to stop actually doing that. I think also having people in my life who encourage me to not work too much. My wife who likes me being home and isn't too accommodating, if that makes sense.
That feels good that you have a wife that wants you to be home.
This is my passive way of saying, hey, Cassie, say you want me home more. No, I'm just kidding.
But not really.
That is helpful. So people in my life to encourage me in this way, and also taking practical steps to curb away from the natural desire I would often have.
I think for me, talking with people who have faced a similar battle, a similar temptation, and learning from them what endurance has looked like, and also learning from them what consequences there are when we don't endure, and actually really taking time to think about what are the consequences here, what happens when I stop fighting and when I just let my mind go completely awire. And so really pressing into that and understanding that, you know, that again, David saw a lifting of his immediate threat. But when we're not obedient to what God has called us to, there are always going to be consequences. And they may not be immediate consequences, but they may be eternal consequences. And so I think having a broader understanding that I just looked up Ephesians 6 as we were sitting here, For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. And so understanding, like, we're not just facing a battle here on earth. It's not just a physical battle, but really what we're going to face is a spiritual battle. And so understanding that these sin things that we battle with are Satan's attacks against us. And so what we really need to ask is, what does faithfulness to God look like in this? And then just pleading with the Lord, I can't do this on my own. I'm deeply discouraged. I need help in this, because this spiritual battle is far too big for me.
I was going to say, similar to the first thing you said, Kirsten, like talking to people who have walked through very similar seasons and experiences, like my sister-in-law has offered to talk to me more about this. And she's kind of the one who helped point some of these things out to me, because these were struggles that she had in coming out of college. And now, like 6 years out, she said she still kind of wrestles with what that has looked like and is still trying to figure it out. And then I think even practically too, it was helpful for me this year. I did still lead a Bible study for NAVS, but I think to intentionally not go to like navigators events and things like that this year was actually super helpful, because I think I was, especially at the beginning of the year, really tempted to go because I think I just wanted the experience and recognition and to like relive some of those things. And I think I knew it was better to create a little bit more distance than that. And then also in talking about like the distractions, I was saying like trying to limit like access to more mindless things or be intentional. And like even what I'm carrying with me, like we're doing a scripture memory group right now, and when I remember where I put it, I try to carry around this little journal that has my scripture memory in it rather than like my phone in my pocket. Right now my phone's in my pocket, but I things like that.
Yeah, I think for me it's people, having people in my life that are willing to talk to me about, people I trust who are willing to talk to me about where I have failed. I think for me, part of the problem where I am right now in life is, another confession is my gut reaction, my sinful gut reaction often when correction comes is defense. And I hate that. And so really where I lean on more than that is just the Spirit's conviction. I need people in my life, but right now that when the Spirit convicts, to listen well to that and to act on that as quickly as I know. I was thinking about this while everyone was talking, while you all were answering this, is that all of the things that we could talk about as ways, practical ways to move beyond this or to fight against it, are really just fights, or they're band-aids to the bigger problem. And what I mean by that, and I'm, by the way, I'm not ridiculing any of you in this because I have the same thing, but I think we've got to look deeper than the little fix on what we're trying to get at, because really at the heart of it is, so for me, I'll put it on me, when I say something sharp, sarcastic to someone, and I know that that's going to make them look silly and me look better for getting a sharp word in quickly, that's a sin against that person, and it's hurtful to that person, and it's damaging to our relationship long term. But more than that, it's dishonoring to God. And I think if we're not able to get to that and see that, none of the other surface things are ever going to change, because we're only going to see them as surface things that, oh, I can cover that up, or I can ask for forgiveness, or whatever that is, and move on. So if we're not able to get to the deep, deep roots of what we're actually doing and dishonoring God, it may be a futile battle.
Yeah, a prayer that I've often prayed, which gets to the root of it, is, God, help me to love you more than I love my work, or love what I think work is going to give me.
Yeah.
It's because really it's a lie that I'm believing that work's going to give me any of that stuff anyway. But it's a lie that's deep inside of me that I believe often.
Yeah, the same prayer, the other side of it, is give me a deep disgust in my sin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, a prayer of mine recently has just been that God would open the eyes of my heart and help me to actually understand the lies that I am believing. And I think maybe that is a key to unlocking a lot of these things is what lies about God and what lies about myself am I believing that I keep going back to this. And so I think that's how the enemy really gets into our minds, is that we all grab onto lies that we actually don't realize are lies. And then those are the things that cause us to keep going back to that. And so really taking time to pray and ask the Lord to open your eyes to see what lies are you believing, and then taking time to battle those lies. And so, you know, for me, a lie that I have to constantly go back to is like, I'm not in control, and no amount of worry is going to change that. And so when anxiety comes up, is, you know, confessing once again, Lord, I'm trying to be in control in a space that I have no control. You're in control. And so, you know, that is one lie that I think I've grabbed onto over and over and over again, thinking that I have some sort of control in this world, and I don't. And so taking time to really consider, what lies am I believing?
I think one thing you said to me last week that was really helpful, Kirsten, was just for me, like, taking time in this season to really be fixing my eyes on, like, understanding God for who he is. And I think the last few years have been easy to be like, oh, I'm kind of chasing after this experience and I'll figure things out as I go. But it's been a lot less about really just intentionally diving in to understand God for who he is, which is the whole point, is getting more of God. And I think that's something that will shift a lot moving forward.
Of all that we just talked about, when we are facing weariness and some different things that we can do, I don't see any record of David doing any of those things. At least it's not recorded. Like, I don't, maybe his men are saying, hey, it's time to, like, get back into Israel, but there's no record of it. I don't see any evidence that he's taking steps to try to help his heart, like, move back out of exile, for lack of a better word. And in chapters to come, we see that David never actually makes that decision. It's kind of made for him that it's time to now get out of Philistia, which may just be God's grace to him forcing his hand.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't even thought about it until you said this, Eric. He's got 400 men with him, yeah, who are all making the same decision to live there for a year and 4 months. So it's not just David alone. He's got a group of people who he has surrounded himself with, who are propping up his behavior with him, which is often what we want to run to. We want to be around people who have the same sort of mentality, because if they have a different mentality than us, then they're either going to, you know, cause us to grow out of that, which we don't really want, because we want to hold on tightly to the things that we're facing. So it is interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way, that he circled himself with a group of people who are willing to prop him up.
When, as I consider the question I asked previously, like, what lie is he believing? I think he believes that getting away from Saul is going to give him the relief that he seeks. It's going to give him the peace that he seeks. And he gets that for a little bit, but, you know, as we'll see later, he doesn't actually stay there. There's no remaining peace that comes from that lifting. And so, you know, he's believing the lie that that relief from this problem is going to ultimately give him peace. And I can relate with that for years and years and years, believing that what God needed to give me with my anxiety was relief. And that was the thing that would help me endure. And really realizing now, looking back, like, had God given me relief, I would have learned to long for the relief more than I longed for God. And so, you know, I think a lot of the times when we're suffering, what we want is relief from the pain. But I think we're human enough that when the relief comes, then that's the thing we long for rather than God.
And then one last little interesting piece. This is something, Vince, that you mentioned before we started recording, is that this is the last record that we have of David and Saul.
Their conflict.
Yeah, of their conflict.
Yeah.
So to be continued.
Yeah.
This next week is chapters, I didn't look, there's just one.
28, and it's a crazy one, people.
Oh, fasten
your seatbelts. Saul is conjuring up the dead Samuel through the Witch of Endor, who has nothing to do with Star Wars, by the way.
So good note.
Yeah,
good note.
Yeah, if you're thinking this Endor is the same
Don't
Endor.
Watch Star Wars this week in preparation.
Yeah.
Shoot, I was going to.
I actually read the chapter, not watch Star Wars instead.
Were the Ewoks from Endor?
Mm-hmm. I think so. Oh, I hope I'm not wrong.
I wonder. You're going to get slaughtered by people if you're wrong. All right, last question. Where do you see God's glory here in these two chapters?
I've said this, I think, maybe every week we've been in Samuel. But the fact that God chooses to use people who are flawed, who are sinful, shows we have a God who's slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love.
For me, I think it's that God allows us to sit in seasons of confusion and hurt, and it doesn't mean that he doesn't have a plan. It doesn't mean that he's not at work in ways that we can't see, and that he's okay with us wrestling with him and messing up. It's not going to derail anything.
I think for me, it's just a reminder that God calls us to endurance, but it's not this thing that we have to muster up on our own, but just that he's walking with us in the midst of that, and that he endured the cross for us. He's the one who endured at the greatest cost, and that's a comfort and a hope in the midst of whatever we may be in too.
Yeah, the angle that I see is that God is incredibly patient. And not only is David still not the ruling king over Israel, and we see Gath repeated, the Ziphites repeated, Saul's confrontation repeated, this is dragging on and on and on, but his patience with his chosen king, David, is incredible as well. This is the guy that God called to be king over his people, and the patience he has with David through all of his, man, lack of trust and lying and everything else. It's a good God that we serve.
Yeah.
All right, chapter 28 next week, and we will, I always want to say see. Hopefully we do see you. See you Sunday.
Not hopefully. We will. We want to. We desire it.
Have a great week. Yeah.